All right. Things that we believe and are sure about. And we're talking about the church now. This will be the final subject of this of the series, though we'll be on it for just a little while, dealing with everything I can think of with regard to the church. And we've been looking at the marks of identification. And a lot of this material, again, it's good for several things. It's good just to set in our minds, to remind ourselves of these things. That's probably 70% of Bible study is just reminding ourselves of these fundamental things with regard to the doctrines of Christ. So it's important with regard to that. It's important, can help us as we think about some of these things as we teach other people. I think I've said all along that particularly these things with regard to the church, it's nothing new at all. These are things that we have taught for years because it's truth. There's no need to change it. And a lot of the charts that you see and things that you see on the screen aren't things that originated with me by any stretch, but they're charts and they're arguments that have been made in public debates and so on and so forth. And so the point of it is they're effective. And again, there's no need to change that. And these are things, one of the things that I discovered in doing the radio program that I did for several years is that it's one thing when you stand before a group of God's people and you make certain arguments about these fundamental things. It's good to do that. But there's no real challenge in that. When you're on a live radio program, there are people who are calling back and questioning some of the arguments that you make. And so, in other words, they become arguments that are tested and tried. And that there's value in that. A lot of times you get up and there are things that I have taught, there's things that I have preached and have never, for whatever reason, even on the radio, people never challenged or anything. So there's some arguments that I have made that I have never really made except for before an audience of God's people. And, you know, that's just the way it is. But when somebody, every argument sounds good when you're arguing with people who mostly agree with what you're saying. But when it's tested and people are challenging them and just asking questions about it, or they might be critics about it and they do their best to disprove what you're saying, and the argument stands, then there's real value in that. And the point of all of this is most of the things that we have dealt with, not only with the church that we're just getting into, but the things that we have presented with the Holy Spirit, those are the arguments and the things, hopefully, that you've taken notes on. These are things that have been, again, talked about in public debate, denominational preachers challenging some of them, but they have always stood the test of time and all the arguments against them. So they become very valuable. And the reason they stand, of course, as I said a few moments ago, is because it's truth. But you can use these things. You can use these arguments when you're in a home Bible study, sitting at your kitchen table with somebody. These are truths that are convincing and can help people see the truth. Because, again, it's truth. And so hopefully there's value in that, as well as just reminding us of these fundamental things. Remember, and these are things that we shouldn't be guessing about. We shouldn't be trying to figure out still. There may be some difference with regard to our babes in Christ who are hearing some of these things for the first time, yet I think most of them are in the class in the back. But for those of us who have been in the church for a while, these should be things that you're absolutely sure about. You may learn some arguments as we go along, but you shouldn't be guessing. Is the Church of Christ right? You should know that. Be sure about it. Have confidence in that. And so that's very, very important. We believe and are sure. So all of these things are things then that we have dealt with. And again, they're effective, the arguments that we set forth. Marks that identify the New Testament church. Name, time, place, founder. These are things you can point out and should point out. There are many counterfeit churches. This society, this world is filled with denominational churches, and so you have to identify the true church, and you can do it in these ways, with the name and the time, the place, and the founder. And so we looked at that. And looking at, again, this is a chart that we have put up through the years. And obviously, we can't put up all of the various denominations. There's too many to fit on a screen. But as you begin to compare it, when was the church established? Around A.D. 30. That's when it started. Any church that started after that can't be the church you read about in the Bible. It just can't be. And because the church you read about in the Bible started at a specific time, in a specific place. There was, of course, the right founder, Christ, and wore scriptural designations. Again, it doesn't have to be, as we talked about, doesn't have to be the church of Christ. Can be the church of God, could be the house of God. We read about that in the Bible. We usually put up on our signs Church of Christ because it's convenient with regard to people traveling and that sort of thing, people letting people know who we are, and it's recognizable. And I prefer that as well as anything because it has the name of Christ in it, and I appreciate that. But Church of God would be just as scriptural. And we'd run into problems, of course, because there's a denomination that's referred to as the church. They call themselves the Church of God. So that's a case where they have the right name, but the wrong church, because they practice unscriptural things. They're organized in an unscriptural way. They're filled with people who haven't even been born again. And so, but they have the right name, see. So that causes a little bit of a problem. I know of situations where, you know, obviously there are churches of Christ. You can't drive down the street and just look at a sign that says Church of Christ and say, oh, that's the right church. Not necessarily so. There's local congregations that have gone astray, that are no longer standing for the truth. There are churches that might be, and we'll talk about this perhaps as we go forward, there are churches out there that might be non-denominational churches that wear the name Church of Christ. Doesn't mean that they're right. I can remember before I started preaching, when I first obeyed the gospel, I attended a debate in Los Angeles, California, and it was a debate between a preacher who was a preacher in the liberal Church of Christ, but he was debating another fella who was, his church was called the Church of Christ. It was a non-denominational situation, but the debate was on the deity of Christ. So the other fella who's church he supposedly was the preacher at was called the Church of Christ, but they denied the deity of Christ and some other things the debate was involved in. And so the point of it is, you can't just look at a sign, can you? There are other marks of identification, but you have to start somewhere. And again, as I've said, you know, you can have the right name and it be the wrong church, but you can't have the right church with the wrong name. There has to be a scriptural designation to it. Something you can read about in the Bible. You can read it in the Bible, and it gives glory to the right one, to the right founder. These are just a few of the situations. Churches starting at the wrong time, wrong place, wrong founder, and wears the wrong designation, then it's not the church you read about in the Bible. And so this has been very effective. Again, we've passed out flyers through the years and have pamphlets that have this chart with a few more denominational churches on it. That's very effective. I would encourage you to use it. We have some, I think, somewhere in the back with the one church, I think it's called, if I'm right, and has maybe this same chart on it. Pass them out to people. It's effective and it's truth. That's the main thing. All right, now let's spend some time then looking at the organization of the New Testament church. And we're still, in looking at this, this is still an identifying mark. All of these things that we deal with regard to this, will be an identifying mark. You can really tell the difference between the New Testament church and denominationalism just by how it's organized. So we'll look at that. Yeah, Dale.
Over Hebrews 12:23, we're talking about the church of the firstborn. I know you've used that name because that's a scriptural name according to what scriptures teach. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen nor even heard of that I recall of a conservative church ever calling themselves that. Have you ever?
No. No, and in truth, I don't know of a conservative church that doesn't wear the title Church of Christ, to be honest with you. But most conservative preachers in conservative churches churches would tell you, just as I have this morning, that you could wear one of these other scriptural designations. And it's really just a matter of people recognizing things and when people are traveling and that sort of thing. And what is wrong with the designation Church of Christ? And we can put our finger on the passage, Romans 16 at verse 16, where it refers to churches of Christ. And so that really is the best designation to use. But it doesn't mean it's the only one. And I've never, even Church of God, I don't know of any conservative congregation that has worn that as a designation. There might be, you know, but I haven't come across it. But we just want to point out that it doesn't have to be Church of Christ. It just has to be scriptural. And so that's the main thing. All right. Now with the organization of the church. And again, these are things I've preached on this several times here and wherever I've been and will continue to do so. But these are fundamental things. You start with the universal church. You see in the white circle there, the universal church is made up of all the saved. Matthew 16 at verse 16, when Jesus said, "Thou art Peter, upon this rock I will build my church." That's what he's talking about, the universal church. So you understand then, if the universal church is made up of all the saved, then those who are a part of it are those who have obeyed the unperverted gospel. So when you have a church out here that doesn't teach the unperverted gospel, then it can't be made up of all the saved. And that's what you find in denominationalism. There's a lot of impressive denominations out there that are large in number, and they do all kind of work that man would consider to be good. And sometimes even their preacher might be a TV evangelist of some sort or whatever. He's beloved by thousands, millions sometimes of people. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how impressive they are outwardly, if you have a fella that's up teaching that all you have to do is believe and you are saved, then you're going to have a church filled with people who believe they were saved by faith alone. Now, we understand, of course, the unperverted gospel says that you have to be baptized into Christ. If you have a church that's filled with people who haven't been baptized into Christ, are they saved? No. No. And that's the real problem with denominationalism. The church that you read about in the Bible is filled with those who are saved. The universal church are those who are saved. But those who are part of the church are those who have obeyed the gospel. And you're added to the church and you're saved at the exact same moment. Acts 2 and at verse 47. But that's the universal church. And when we talk about there being one church, that's what we're talking about. There's one church. There's one body. There's one house of God. There's one temple. There's one kingdom. That's all referring to the universal church. And then, of course, we think about the local church. And now, when it comes down to local churches, we know there's a plurality of local churches. And a local church, as we've said many times before, Christians who have agreed to work together in a specific geographical location, like at 1835 Brown Street. This is a local church. Local churches are important. Local churches are a part of God's pattern. And when we turn to the Bible, we see Christians were a part of local churches. That's the arrangement that God has made. Why? Because they're made up of elders, deacons, and saints. The elders, of course, have the oversight. God wants his people to be under oversight. That's his plan. Now, we understand that there are some congregations that don't have elders. Why? Because they don't have men that qualify. So it may be a sound church, but they're not totally organized the way God wants them to be. Now, he'd rather a congregation not have elders than a congregation have unscriptural elders. So you don't just put anybody into being an elder, obviously. And many churches have made that mistake, and it has caused all kind of problems through the years. It is usually devastating when a church has unscriptural elders, and things go terribly badly. But you might have a local church that doesn't have men that qualify. We have example of that. Remember in Acts chapter 14, of course, that Paul went back. He established local churches, and then later on his second journey, he went back and he appointed elders in these various churches. Well, what does that tell you about those local churches when they were first founded?
They didn't have elders.
So they went a time without having elders. So, but a local church, then they have elders that oversee. That's God's plan. So He obviously wants His people to be under an eldership. Now here's the key again that we point out. This is God's plan. It's His pattern. And so every individual, you obey the gospel of Christ, and because the first thing that you're worried about is your relationship with God. That's the first thing. Your fellowship with God. Second comes your fellowship with other Christians in a local church. But just because that's second doesn't mean it's not important. The pattern that we find in the New Testament is that individuals obey the gospel, then they join themselves to a local church. God doesn't want floaters. He doesn't want you just being out there in the universal church. He wants you to be a member of a local church. That's the pattern. And that's what we see over and over and over again. The local church is God's arrangement. And so it's important that we have that. And a lot of it is because you have your accountability. You're under the oversight of elders. And again, all of that is God's arrangement. Now, as we point out many times, with a local church, then you always had a plurality of elders. Acts 14, Acts 20. Now, I don't think in this audience we have to look at those passages and go into detail, but certainly there has to be a plurality of elders. Those passages and others will verify that. What we don't have ever in the New Testament is an example of a local church with a pastor or a bishop. All right, we don't have any of that. That all came later. In the New Testament church, you had, of course, elders, plural, and they only were to oversee the flock, which was among them, 1 Peter 5 at verse 2. And so that's the scriptural pattern that has to be followed. And it's very important. One of the things that we'll see is that with regard to denominationalism, this is the thing that was violated, that was destroyed, that led to denominationalism. And so we'll look at that in a minute. But it's very important to see the church. So with regard to then the church you read about in the Bible, this is all that you ever see. It sometimes is referring to the universal church, Matthew 16, 18, other passages, all the saved. Or it's referring to local churches with elders, deacons, and saints. That's it. There's nothing bigger or smaller. There's nothing in between. That's it. Anything that doesn't look like that is something you don't read about in the Bible. Anything that's different than that is a man-made church. And now, this is very easy to point out to people. Because, as we'll see, with regard to denominationalism, they all look different than that. So it's an identifying mark. It's something people can look at and say, you know, when you start talking about this, for example, with there always being a plurality of elders, you could just ask people, do you have a pastor in your church, the pastor? And they'll always say yes, because every denomination has that arrangement. Now, of course, sometimes you have to explain a little more because they might have more than one pastor, but they always have a head pastor or someone in the chief position, and the other ones will be assistant pastors. But there's always a man who's in charge, who has the most authority. And so that's easy to point out to people. And you can just give examples to people. I've been in Bible studies before where individuals have volunteered, as I get to talking about this, they have volunteered different information about the church that they attend. One fella was telling me, you know, the pastor is a fella who I taught when he was a young guy, taught him in the Bible class. And of course, he went off to college and he got his degrees and everything and became the pastor of the particular church. And this fella, he was an older man, but he was telling me how this young man now got angry at him because he called him by his name. He called him whatever, well, I can't remember the name of it, whatever, called him by his name, and he was angry. Why? Because he didn't call him Reverend so-and-so. Because now he's in charge. Now he has all the authority, and he doesn't even want this older man who taught him when he was just a young fella in Bible class, referring to him by his name, you have to, I'm Reverend so-and-so. Well, that's a vivid example. That was something that this man volunteered to me as we talked about this kind of thing. He could see, you know, there's something wrong with that. I do attend a congregation, a church that has a pastor, and he's in charge. He's the boss. And so this is very vivid. It's something that people in almost every denomination can see. So this is the order. Now let's look at then a typical denominational church. A typical denominational church is a church of churches. That's something you can remember. And now we're getting at really, what makes a denomination a denomination? How many of you think, and you don't have to raise your hand or anything, but how many of you think that what makes a denomination is false doctrine? That doesn't make a denomination a denomination. There are a lot of churches out there. Now, it's become very popular now to be a non-denominational church. And when someone tells you, oh, I'm a member of a non-denominational church, don't think in your mind right away, oh, they just don't know what it is. They may very well be. Chances are they are a part of a non-denominational church. Now, sometimes people will say that and they just don't know what a denomination is and they are a part of a denomination. But there are a lot of these mega churches now are non-denominational churches. They don't have a specific affiliation with the group. They don't have a headquarters and that sort of thing that's dictating to them. They are independent. An independent church is not a denomination. But see, we don't think that because we think right away, every religious thing out here except for the Church of Christ, they're all denominations. Well, it's helpful to start understanding what a denomination is. It's not. Now, do denominations teach false doctrine? Yes. But I'm saying to you, it's not the false doctrine that makes them a denomination. It's their organizational arrangement that makes them a denomination. A denomination is a church of churches. All of these local churches inside this blue circle, they're all connected. They're all under the control of a man or group of men. And a lot of these denominations, they're all teaching the same thing. On a Sunday morning like this, every local church of a particular denomination, they'll all be studying Mark something something because they're dictated to by the ones who are in charge over the denomination. So you could put a line between all of these, a connector between all of these local churches. It's a church of churches. There's no autonomy. There's no independence. And all of those churches together then make up that particular denominational church. So when you think denomination, you think church of churches. Now think back then. Now I didn't point it out. I probably should have, but I didn't point out on the screen before those local churches. And you know this, but those local churches are all autonomous, aren't they? I sort of pointed out, but I just didn't go into detail. The elders are to oversee the flock which is among them. That points to autonomy. That means the elders of the local church, they have no business getting into the business of other local churches. They can only oversee the flock which is among them. Well, that's different with denominationalism. They don't have that independence. They don't have that autonomy. And that's what makes them a local, a denomination. Look at how this all got started. We understand that the Catholic Church was the first denominational church. And they're just like all those other denominations that you saw on the screen before you. They're just like the Baptist Church and the Lutheran Church in their organizational structure. Obviously there's some differences between Protestant churches and the Catholic Church, but they're all a church of churches is the point. And they're just different in a matter of degree when it comes down to it. But all of those other churches, starting with the Lutheran Church, We know right now this is when they were established. They did not. There was no Lutheran church before 1520. When we think of the Catholic Church, it's a little bit different in that they evolved over a 500-year period of time. So that you hear, I think I mentioned last week, you read in history of popes that existed before 606 that we usually put up on the screen as the starting point of the Catholic Church. And if you don't know that, you know, people on the radio program would call it, oh, well, there was a pope before 606, and we know that. In fact, there were times when there were two popes at the same time, one in the east and one in the west. And so it because the Catholic Church, well, it was evolving into what it is today. And this just, in a nutshell, is how it happened. And just keep in mind what we had on the screen in the first place with regard to the New Testament church. Universal church, local church. Nothing in between those two things. Well, step one, a distinction was made between a bishop and an elder. The bishop became the head elder and was known as the presiding bishop. And that happened pretty early. Remember, I made a remark before that I'm not quite sure when it got to the place where a local congregation had a pastor. I just know that it happened either very early in the second century or at the end, the very end of the first century. But it was early. And we don't know exactly when it happened. We just know it happened. Because we can look in history and it came about. And we know when we look in the Bible, you don't have one example of a pastor over a local church. But they started to pop up. And we start having references of that in history. And this is, at some point then, somebody, it's all a power thing. Somebody, some elder decided, I want to be the head elder. And so I'm going to call myself bishop, and you all are still elders, and I'm, as the head elder, I'm now the bishop. And again, we don't know the details of that or of what conversation people had or how that came about, but we know it came about because we see it in history. We see the presiding bishop then in history. The problem is when you open up your Bible, you see that an elder and a bishop are exactly the same thing. Is referring to the same office. Titus chapter 1 at verse 5 beginning, you see a reference. Those terms bishop and elder are used interchangeably. So a bishop is an elder. An elder is a bishop. But a distinction started to be made. Now if you're a bishop, that's a little more significant. You have a little more clout than just being a little elder over here. You're a bishop. Distinction started to be made. And then step 2. Now keep in mind this happened over a 500-year period of time. This didn't happen in a month. It didn't happen in a few months. It happened over years. The bishop had his authority extended to congregations other than the one that appointed him. The presiding bishop became known as the metropolitan bishop. What is it all about? Power. More power. And people just want, when you start giving man power and he's going to want more and more of it. And that's how this thing really evolved. And so now you have a metropolitan bishop. He has more clout than the presiding bishop. And step number 3, the combining of churches of a large area under a single government. This area became known as a diocese. The metropolitan bishop became the diocesan bishop. More authority over more people, over more churches, more power. More power. Then, step number 4, by the close of the 5th century, this system had spread until 5 centers ruled the world of Christianity. Alexandria, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome. And you had 5 men in those places. They were called patriarchs. And so now they had the authority, and they... Now remember, Paul talked about the church going into apostasy. This is the church going into apostasy. And I mentioned last week about, this idea of can we, during all of this happening, can we trace where there is somewhere where there's just a local church with elders, deacons, and say, I don't know. I can't trace that. In my hearts of hearts, I would say, I think there were congregations still, even when all of this was going on and this apostasy was taking place, that there were local churches remaining strong and sound. I truly believe that was the case. I just couldn't prove it. Other than the fact that the kingdom would never be destroyed and that sort of thing, that kind of argumentation, we can't put our finger on it in history. because the church was going off into apostasy. And I mean this, as you begin looking at the history of the second century and third century, it becomes very difficult. Things become very blurred. And so it was the church slowly going off into error. And again, Paul told us that that was going to happen, that many would leave the faith and that sort of thing. But then step number five, finally, the development of the Pope in 588 A.D., this fellow John the Faster, he was one of the patriarchs. He claimed to be the universal Pope. Can't remember what city he was ruling from, but anyway, he claimed to be the universal Pope, but it didn't work. You know, he wanted that authority. He wanted to be the man over all of Christianity, but they shot him down. The other ones are saying, now, wait a minute. And they didn't allow him to have that. But, you know, once you plant a seed, once something is introduced, even when it's shot down, it over a period of time, it seems to keep coming up and getting closer and closer. Finally, in 606 A.D., Boniface III was able to make the claim of being the Pope. Papal authority was established at that point. So when we put on the screen that the Catholic Church started in 606, what we're really saying is it was at that time when you had the kind of organizational structure that you still have in the Catholic Church today, where you have one man who is the ruler of that entire denomination. In fact, now, of course, they claim he's the head of the church on earth. But before that, you had maybe even references to Catholicism and that sort of thing, but it was still evolving. But in 606, you had the one man who had the authority. Now, when you think about that, and you think of the difference between the Protestant church and the Catholic church, what is the difference except for, again, in degree? That's it. It's a church of churches, no matter how you look at it. The only difference is the Protestant, they don't have one man over all of the world. They just have one man or a group of men, particularly a group of men who rule that particular denomination. It's just a matter of degree. It is still, of course, different than what you read about in the Bible. This church of churches, you don't read about. We've often pointed out through the years, you take a denomination. You put any denominational name you want to up there. Catholic Church, Baptist Church, Lutheran Church, anyone you want to. They're all composed of a church of churches. And none of them would claim. Now, I don't know that even the Catholic, used to be the Catholic Church would claim that they were the only ones saved. They would make that claim. That has become a very unpopular approach. So if you talk to the average denominational scholar, the Baptist preacher, whatever, they won't even claim to be the universal church. They'll tell you no, because they recognize we're not made up all the same. They believe the Lutherans over here are saved, and the Episcopalians over here, they're saved, and all the Baptists, they're saved. And their concept would be all of these denominational churches make up the one body. But when you look in the Bible, what makes up the one body? People. Not churches. Not even local churches of Christ. People. Individual people who are baptized into Christ. Are churches baptized into Christ? No. The church is made up of those who obey the gospel, who are baptized into Christ. Made up of people. But denominational folk, they think, no, they'll have the one body. You put a screen, you put a circle up there and say the one church. You believe there's one church? They would all say yes. But inside the circle, they'll have Baptist church, Lutheran church, whatever, all these different denominations. Where a biblical, scriptural picture of that would be the one circle and individual people in that circle. Because that's the universal church. It's made up of what? All the saved. Individuals who are baptized into Christ. So again, the point is then, a typical denomination made up of churches, that's not the universal church. It's too small for that. Would you call that, what you see on the screen, a local church? No. It's too big for that. Preachers used to, when I first obeyed the gospel, I would remember preachers saying this all the time. I don't know if I first got it when they were saying it. But they would always say anything larger than the local church, smaller than the universal church, is the denominational church. And that now I understand this is what they're talking about. This is what they were talking about. These denominations, too small to be the universal church, too large to be the local church, they're right in between. Here's the problem. It's unscriptural. You don't see that thing in between in the New Testament. All you see is the local church, or the universal church, local churches. That's it. There is nothing in between. Anything in between you don't read about in the Bible, that makes it unscriptural. Furthermore, it's anti-scriptural because all of that points to division. It promotes and encourages division. See, particularly that picture that I was talking about a while ago, when they have the one body made up of all these different denominations that are supposed to make up the universal church, but all these denominations teach different things. They wear different names. They practice different things. And they applaud that. But it's division. The very term denomination points to division. And Jesus prayed in John chapter 17 that all his disciples be one. He doesn't want division. He wants all his disciples to speak the same thing and be of the same mind. And so denominationalism is not only unscriptural, you never read anything about it, it's actually anti-scriptural. It goes against the very thing that God wants, that Jesus prayed for, that Paul pled for in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And so it's unscriptural. This is what you find in the New Testament church. That's the mark of identification. When it comes down to the organization of the church, this is what you should show people. Universal church, local church. There isn't anything else. If you're a part of anything other than that, an individual who has been baptized into Christ, so you're a part of the universal church, who has joined yourself according to the pattern to a local church. If you've done anything else, a part of anything else, you're a part of something that's not the New Testament church. It's very simple to lay out. That's the organizational structure of the church. It's very much different than any denominational church. And so you can really point it out and show the distinction and the difference in those things. Next week, we'll start talking about the work of the church, because the work of the church is very much different than what you see in the denominational world as well. Appreciate your attention.